right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the WGN Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. Get your request in now, one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. So today marks the anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire. It happened in 1871. And there's a lot of myths surrounding that fire and a lot of facts and a lot of history regarding that. And we're going to talk about that with our guest here, Max Grinnell, who is the urbanologist. You can check out theurbanologist.com. Follow him on Twitter at theurbanologist. And he's a historian, and we're going to talk about the great Chicago Fire and more. Let's bring Max to the show. Max, welcome to the show.
Nick, so glad to be with you tonight.
All right, man. Tell us what an urbanologist is.
It's someone who teaches and writes about the urban condition. So I teach urban studies. I'm the author of several books on Chicago, including my first book, geez, almost 20 years ago, was about the history of Hyde Park. I came to the city 25 years ago to go to school at the University of Chicago. I was fascinated by the South Side, the process of urban renewal, kind of conversations about that place, and kind of grew from there. So that's been kind of part of my work ever since.
So tell me about what it is that you like so much about Chicago. Why is it so fascinating? Why do you, why are you compelled to be a part of the city?
I think the thing that still gets me excited decades later is the thing that there's always, you know, I always tell my students, cities are always changing. So you think about all the stuff we've seen that's happened with expansion of universities in the South Loop these days, the rise and fall of a kind of transformation of Near North, which most people know as River North. And you think about how the city's transportation and cultural networks are kind of always in flux. And I think things are always in cycles in a big city like Chicago. I think you'll always find something new. And I think the best way you can do that, as you know so well, is through talking by those people who know the city and taking the time to slow down and talk to other people around them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm born and raised in Chicago. Never lived anyplace else, and always lived in the city. Never in the suburbs or anything. I've always been in the city, and I love this city. I absolutely love Chicago. I just think it's
great. A man after my own heart.
Yeah, it's a great town. Now, what happened? What tell me about the website, The Urbanologist. What goes on there?
A few years ago, when I was thinking, how do I, you know, you know, everyone has kind of a different way to present themselves online, the good, the bad, the other. And I thought of, well, all my interests focus around, you know, kind of cities, and specifically a lot of the time Chicago. So I thought urbanologist, I quite literally, Nick, looked it up in a dictionary. I was like, this is a word I'd seen before, someone who explores the urban condition. I still get questions. People say, did you make the word up? Is it something, you know, you just like push two words together? And I said, it's a real word. It's a real word. Mm-hmm. It is an actual word. And I was like, what the hell? Let's jump on it. And to be honest with you, urbanologist.com was already taken. Someone had already squatted on that website. So I should have gotten on it years before. So it just became the urbanologist.
Ah, you added that the in there. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. All right. Now, where do you teach?
I teach urban studies at the University of Chicago, and I teach mostly undergraduates. We do like a survey class where we're out doing field research. Students may pick, quite literally in my class, I have students do an assignment where they'll pick an intersection in the city. So we could be talking North and Halsted. We could be talking 55th and Halsted. You know, they'll pick an intersection, and they'll look at how that corner has evolved over time. That's kind of our gateway for thinking about who's there now, who's been there in the past. And of course, people look and they say, hey, there's a building there. There used to be another type of land use there. And that kind of gets the ball rolling for thinking about how cities have changed. Yeah. And it's always, it's hard. You know, the challenge I always tell everybody is And I'm not immune to this either. It's, you know, getting people to put down their phones and talk to other people. So that's the biggest challenge of what I do every day.
Yeah, I bet. I like that idea of like picking an intersection and looking at it now as opposed to how it changed. I grew up in Wrigleyville. I grew up about six blocks away from Wrigley Field, and that area now, I don't even know what's going on.
I mean, it's my God.
It's insane now. So different than it was when I was growing up.
Yeah. I mean, you think of all the, I mean, the fact that there's that, the massive hotel and kind of the entertainment landscape you might find around, you know, another stadium. It still blows my mind as well, just to think about all the changes over there. It's kind of insane.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I mean, having known that area, you know, through my entire childhood, it just, every time I go near Wrigley Field now, I'm completely blown away by how it is. I don't even recognize the area anymore. It's really crazy how it's changed.
Yeah, the number of holdouts over there. I mean, you think about a handful of bars, maybe G-Man, you say Lounge, but certainly, you know, again, like I always tell my students, like, do you want to get more money out of your land or less money? The situation over there, they're working towards a lot more money.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is, you know, that's what happens. You win a World Series, and then the whole landscape changes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I remember thinking, boy, this is it. Staying up all night, all those nights watching, and I'm a Cubs fan, so it was a great victory.
Yeah, it was fantastic. All right, so it is the anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire. Everybody, whenever we talk about the Chicago Fire, you always talk about Mrs. O'Leary and the cow. That's the first thing that pops up.
Absolutely.
Always. And she's been exonerated, over the, you know, in the past. And so we should stop blaming Mrs. O'Leary and her damn cow, for the Chicago Fire. Why does that always pop up?
Well, you know, it pops up in a kind of, something that's close to my heart. Of course, like a lot of other people, I hope it came up because a newspaper man wrote a story about it. And it was a fellow whose name was Michael Ahern, worked for the Chicago Republican, long gone newspaper by this point, who made this claim that the fire had started when the cow kicked over a lantern.
Right.
It was not, of course, true. It was the O'Leary family barn. They, you know, they did have animals on the property, but this is kind of conjured up. And, of course, this is part of the thing when the city council exonerated Mrs. O'Leary and her family in 1997. This is one of the things that said, listen, this is a completely fabricated story. But, you know, it sounds kind of good, right? Here you are in the city, rapid industrialization. People still have, they're keeping domesticated animals. And look, now we're faced with the same thing again in 2019 with this brouhaha about should people allowed to keep goats in their backyard.
So, right.
You know, with your locavores and other folks. And I personally think, why not? You know, hey, if you want an animal in your backyard, but I don't live close to a goat. So I guess that's probably part of the conversation. And of course, you know, memorialized later in all kinds of movies, a very famous illustration from Harper's Magazine, So people would purchase that and see it. So no radio or TV at that point in the 1870s, so people are getting all that news through print, and it kind of I want to avoid saying it spread like a Chicago fire, but it just happened.
Yeah, but it was perpetual. It happened. I mean, like this, the Mrs. O'Leary's cow was the thing that everybody talked about when it came up, when the Chicago Fire came up. Now the fire, which happened on started on October 8th, 1871. It killed between 200 and 300 people. It destroyed 17,450 buildings. Hundreds of 100,000 people were homeless. An estimated $200 million in 1871 dollars in damage. And, yeah, I mean, it's still gone down in history as one of the biggest fires ever. And but what is it that about this fire that makes it so legendary? Because there's been fires in other cities, major fires in other cities. But what is it about this one?
You know, I think, Nick, the thing about the Great Chicago Fire is the Chicago had gone through such a rapid growth from that, from the 1830s to 1871. It was a city in which you had had, you know, pioneering types of construction, the consolidations of the, you know, start of the meatpacking industry, timber, and all these other things that were starting to happen so exponentially quicker, faster than any other American city out. And, you know, at the time was referred to as the old Northwest, the Middle West, later the Midwest. And people were excited, intrigued, especially back east and other parts of the world, about Chicago's rapid growth, right? It seemed almost impossible. And so I think that's kind of a key part of the story. And certainly, you know, if you read those newspaper accounts in the days and weeks and months following the fire, there was that spirit of, we will rebuild. There's a famous quote, and I've used this sometimes when I've taken my students over by, you know, the Chicago Fire Academy on what was then DeCoven Street, and talked a little bit about this. And a famous headline that read from the Tribune, "Cheer up. In the midst of a calamity without parallel in the world's history, looking upon the ashes of 30 years accumulation, the people of this once beautiful city have resolved that Chicago shall rise again." And of course, just like many texts these days, there's a lot, those last four words are in bold face.
Right.
So you just, you make sure, don't forget. And of course, the success after the fire and the rebuilding, tremendous.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, hang on, Max, okay?
Sure.
All right, Max Rinella is here with us. He's the urbanologist. Check out theurbanologist.com for his website. And we're going to come back, talk more about it. It's the anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire. We'll talk more about it after we take a break here on 720 WGN.
Now, when I was a young boy, at the age of five, my mother said, I'm going to be the greatest man alive.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Two for Tuesday, get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Yeah. So we are talking with Max Grinnell, who is an urbanologist. Theurbanologist.com is his website. He's an historian, and he teaches classes and studies this city as well. It is the anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire, October 8th, 1871, we're talking a little bit about that. Max, welcome back.
Good to be here, Nick.
All right, man. So, so how long did it take? You know, after the fire destroyed so much of the city, how long did it take to rebuild? Did it take a very long time to rebuild, or?
You know, the rebuilding started almost immediately. The fire went as far north, almost about Fullerton Avenue, and south and west of Mrs. O'Leary's barn, about a mile or so. So it's a vast area, and as you already mentioned in the introduction, thousands of buildings destroyed. But that spirit was that the city would need to rebuild, and fairly quickly. Kind of, you think about those key networks today, a lot of the major railroad stations were gone, but a lot of the trackage and stuff still persisted. And if you think about today, what if O'Hare, Midway were out of commission for weeks or months, you know, devastating effect on the city and Chicagoland's economy. But fortunately, they were able to rebuild a lot of those structures fairly quickly. And interestingly enough, and this has come up a few times with other folks, you can, of course, see some of the buildings that are still around. A couple weeks ago, as the celebration for the 150th anniversary of the Water Tower. So that's famously sometimes repeated as we talk about those myths around the fire.
Yeah.
As the only building that survived the Chicago fire, that's not true. And I'll tell you, that's a building to me that every time I look at it, I see something new.
Yeah.
Great building material. You got your Joliet limestone. And of course, it was damaged during the fire, but that's certainly the most famous structure that we still have today. Interested folks are listening. You want to go up to 2100 block of North Cleveland in Lincoln Park, you can still see a couple famous buildings, a couple kind of modest cottages now worth, $1-2 million.
Yeah.
that also survived the fire. So there are those little structures that were, those are kind of the things that are still left from that time period, which if you think about kind of the history of the city, you know, every city is based on creative destruction. We tear down, we build, we tear down, we build. It's kind of neat to think that some of those places are, we can go by and say, wow, this place made it through the Chicago fire.
Yeah. Yeah. And the water tower is just, the water tower is just a beautiful building and just amazing to look at.
I'm glad to hear someone else say that, Nick. You know, sometimes people say, oh my God, how the hell is this thing still here?
No, I like that. I love that building. I think it's great. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was kind of interesting side note. It was the first structure in the city of Chicago that people really said, yes, we must preserve this, because of course when they widened Michigan Avenue after World War One, they were like, yeah, we need to get rid of this.
Yeah.
get rid of this, we're gonna have lots of cars coming by. Fortunately, we still have it.
Yeah. And it's a very unique looking, you know, like, and especially like right in the middle of all the modern buildings that are all over the place, and that thing that thing just sticks out in a beautiful way, in a really beautiful way. I think it's a unique looking building, and the history of it is great, and the fact that it's smack dab in the middle of a whole bunch of modern buildings, I love that it sticks out like that. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's at a great crossroads for people watching.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, going back to the fire again, weather and wooden buildings. A lot of people are saying the weather, it was a very dry weather, and it's lots of wooden buildings. How accurate is that in how the fire spread in that way?
It's pretty much spot on, Nick. For the 3 or 4 months preceding the fire, the city had maybe an inch or so, based on what we understand about kind of weather. Weather records from the time, obviously dealing with a severe drought. And of course, if you think about at the time, a lot of the structures, you know, almost 2/3 were made entirely of wood. Buildings, usually had like a tar shingle roof on them. Doesn't help the situation. City sidewalks at the time, we're not dealing with poured concrete, also wood, roadbeds, lots of wood. So in general, kind of perfect storm type of conditions for that scenario. And of course, famously, this is kind of the thing that always kind of imagine, if you think about yourself being there. I guess the closest thing is to go look at the diorama at the Chicago History Museum, is those fire whirls that developed and quite literally moved the fire across the Chicago River, because a lot of people thought, you know, kind of, if you go back and look at journals and diaries, oh, well, the Chicago River is reaching a body of water. How is the fire going to continue? And yet, because of these fire whirls, it did.
And how long did it burn?
Burned almost, kind of about 2 days.
Yeah.
And of course, some of those initial reports were, rather fascinating. If folks are interested, you can look up a lot of the stuff. Some of it's online through the Chicago History Museum website. You get that sense of how concerned people were. One of my favorites is, it's a letter from a fellow named Jonas Hutchinson, who's a lawyer in the loop, and he said, wrote his mom the second day of the fire and said, "Dear mother, this has been an eventful day. Last night at about 9:30, a fire broke out here, and from that time to this, it has raged fearfully. We are in ruins." And he goes on to kind of talk about that. So, like I always tell people, and you're probably the same way, you look for those kind of sources where you can, because you don't need to manufacture the drama or the tragedy. It's right there in front of you.
Yeah.
Provided if you're looking at the original, if you can read the elaborate script.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let me ask you this. There was always a rumor or a theory that Schlitz, the beer from Milwaukee, came. They brought a whole bunch of Schlitz beer down to Chicago to give the people of Chicago something. Is that true?
Oh, the story about the Schlitz beer.
Yeah,
it's interesting because there's been so many conversations about that over the years. My understanding is that was kind of part of that. And of course, they did in fact send barrels of beer down.
Yeah.
I am by no means expert on that particular aspect, but you know, anything involving kind of, you know, malt and hops does usually interest me.
Well, you know, the thing, the thing is, I'm not a drinking man anymore, but when I was, Schlitz was my brand, and
there we go.
Oh yeah, I mean, and so like any stories about Schlitz, and I still, even though I don't drink anymore, I still collect Schlitz memorabilia. You know, and because I love it, I love the logo, and I love. And you know, there's always that aspect of the history of Schlitz being connected to the Chicago Fire, and I always thought that was pretty cool.
Well, I mean, if you think about another kind of great product that is, you know, throughout the upper Midwest and something that endured, maybe not through Prohibition. I mean, yeah, beer is near the top of the list. And I have heard that, and I don't have any other. Wish I had some more salient details on that. I'm by inclination, I'm an old style man. So it'd been even better if it had been Heilman's fully krausenized or whatever it says on the label. But the Schlitz story.
Yeah, it's a great story. But you know, one of the things that's so Chicago. I mean, obviously, old style is you know, part and parcel. It's Chicago. I love the taverns that have the old style signs. Like your corner tavern that has the old style sign on that. That's so quintessentially Chicago, you know?
I mean, if you think about kind of keeping with this whole thing or theme of reinvention, you know, you think about all the craft brewery scene. I mean, kind of even starting with kind of the first movers decades ago with the folks at Goose Island, which I know people don't consider a craft brew. But that's another part of that. That's another kind of important part of that story, I think.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. I remember when you had to go to Goose Island on Clybourne in order to drink Goose Island beer.
That's right.
You
I remember
had to
that
do
too.
That.
Yeah. It was a kind of a sense of experience. I remember briefly in the late 90s, you could get New Glarus beer in Illinois, which of course was no longer the case anymore.
Yeah.
But now you gotta go up north.
Yeah. All right. What are you working on now, Max? And anything new?
Well, and it's funny. It's actually on WGN a couple months ago talking about this. I am working on a new book, kind of bringing a couple things together on my first trip to Chicago, which was in 1992 when I was a teenager. I took the train at a Amtrak pass across the country. 45 days.
Wow.
Stayed in Chicago, New Orleans, D.C., took a break in Charlottesville, Virginia to go to a high school program, and I did it all by myself, which, not to pat myself on the back, but as I always tell my students, this is before the rise of the World Wide Web, so it was me, Let's Go USA travel book, some some American Express traveler's checks, and a phone card.
Wow.
So that's kind of telling that story. And I've been doing some deep dives into everything from kind of the Chicago experience with hostels to things that were different at the time, CTA, skip stop system, and even kind of getting into a wormhole of research about the space on North Winthrop next to Loyola's campus where Chicago's youth hostel used to be, which is now a grassy field. So that's my book project right now, and
cool,
fingers crossed it'll be done next year. But it's been kind of fun looking at that, my time in Chicago, 27 years ago.
Yeah,
wow,
that's great, man.
Time flies.
Hey, thanks for joining me tonight to talk about the Chicago Fire and more. Check out theurbanologist.com. Max, pleasure to talk to you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Nick.
Okay,
you
man.
Well.
Take care, buddy. There you go. Max Grinnell, everybody. Theurbanologist.com is his website. We were talking about the anniversary of the Chicago Fire. Okay, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN.